Chapter 7, September 11th, in the Partisan Ceasefire. Like most Americans, I will never forget where I was on the morning of September 11th, 2001. It is etched in my memory forever. I was traveling with the president as he was preparing to talk about education reforms and his reading initiative in particular at an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida. It was part of a two-day swing aimed at urging Congress to finally get Bush's education package passed. I was the deputy press secretary at the time. Press Secretary R.A. Flasher was traveling with the president aboard Air Force One, while I was traveling with the larger press corps accompanying the president in their chartered plane. The president had participated in an education event at an elementary school in Jacksonville, Florida, the day before, and we all had spent the night at the Colony Beach Resort in Sarasota, which was planning to close for the season after we left that day. The press buses with the larger traveling White House press corps left the resort about a half hour ahead of the president's motorcade so that they could pre-position at Emma E. Booker Elementary School. Typically, the network set up a transmission room that has all their broadcast needs, including a pool feed of the president's remarks on television screens. A filing center where reporters can write and send their news stories and receive briefings is set up for the entire press corps, usually including a podium for briefings by the press secretary or other administration officials. A White House press office is always located nearby. After arriving at the school and checking out the transmission room / filing center and press office, in this instance they were all located together in a classroom, I went into the school library where the president was scheduled to speak following a classroom visit. The network camera and sound crews and the local media stations were already in place on the press platform behind the seats for the audience members, which would include school administrators, teachers, and parents. Seats in the back were reserved for White House reporters. I sat down between Judy Keene of USA Today and David Sanger of the New York Times. We were chatting casually when my pager went off. I pulled up the incoming message. Brian Bravo, a young aide in the press office, was on top of the breaking news as it was being reported right around 8:50 a.m. that morning. A plane had hit the World Trade Center in New York. I wondered how such a weird accident could happen. Was it a small plane whose pilot had suffered a heart attack and lost control of his craft? Had there been some massive failure by the traffic control system? It seemed very mysterious. "That's terrible," I said aloud. Judy asked, "What?" I said, "The AP is reporting that a plane has hit the World Trade Center." She and David were both as shocked as I. We quickly moved from the filing center to see it on television. Most of the traveling press corps joined us, if they were not already there. We were all listening and watching intently, trying to find out what had happened, when suddenly, a reporter shouted out, "Another plane just hit the other tower!" I think I'd noticed another explosion out of the corner of my eye as I was talking to someone, but I thought it might have been a secondary explosion. "Are you sure?" I inquired. Others were questioning whether it was a new one as well. Moments later, it was replayed, and we all saw the second plane crashing into the second tower. Chills went up my arms and back. The idea that someone had attacked America in a dramatic and deadly way began to penetrate my consciousness. Instantly, most of the reporters turned and looked at me, standing at the back of the small filing center. It was a natural reaction on their part. This was big news, and they were looking for answers. What is the White House hearing and doing? But they knew I would need to go find out. "I'll be back," I said. I needed to track down the senior staff traveling with us that day and see what they knew. As I walked out of the filing center, one of our advanced staffers saw me and said without my asking, "Follow me, I'll get you to the hold." This was a private room set up as a quiet workspace with secure and non-secure phones for us to use during a presidential visit. On this occasion, the presidential hold was the same as the senior staff hold. It was next to the classroom where the president was observing a class of second graders participate in a reading lesson and reading along with them. The only way to get to the hold was to walk through the small classroom. As the advanced staffer and I approached the classroom, the press pool was leaving. They had just filmed the president reading to the class and now were being escorted out, as would usually be the case in a photo op of this kind. Just a moment earlier, the pool had filmed Andy Card walking up to the president and whispering into his ear, "A second plane hit the second tower. America is under attack." It's a moment that has since been replayed countless times. As we entered the classroom, Some in the press pool asked if I knew anything more about the plane crash in New York. They hadn't heard about the second plane yet. "We just saw a second plane hit the second tower on television," I informed them. Ann Compton of ABC News couldn't hear me very well. She asked me, "Did you say there was a second plane?" "Yes," I replied. "A second plane hit the second tower. That's all I know." The advanced staffer then pointed me to the staff hold on my left. As I entered the classroom and walked across the back toward the hold, I looked at the president, who was sitting in a teacher's chair in front of the students. A student was reading, but the president's mind was clearly on the attacks. I had never seen that kind of distant expression on his face before. I could see in his eyes that he knew we were at war. I joined the other traveling staff in the hold. Moments later, the president entered and saw the burning towers on the television set. Then he sat down and took some phone calls, seeking more information. I remember him instructing someone to turn off the television. Bush usually likes a distraction-free environment. Ari Fleischer was there, as were Dan Bartlett, Andy Card, Carl Rove, and Deborah Lauer, an NSC staff member and director of the White House Situation Room. Bush spoke individually by secure phone with the vice president, FBI Director Robert Mueller, who'd been on the job just 1 week, and Governor Pataki of New York. Cheney and Mueller told the president what they knew, which, as far as I could sense, was not much more than we already knew. The president told Pataki to let New Yorkers know that the federal government would do all it could to help with the response. After the calls, the president got a yellow pad to scribble some notes about what he would say before departing the school. The senior staff president huddled with the president. The visit had been scheduled as a two-tiered event: a stop in the classroom and then some remarks on education to the 30 or so audience members assembled in the library. The plan now was to have the president say a few words about what had happened and let those present and the media know that he had to return to Washington immediately to tend to the unfolding tragedy. I stood just to one side near the president. Dan stood next to him, and Ari was seated with him at the table. The president had indicated he didn't need a formal prepared statement. Now he spoke out loud, writing parts of what he would say as Dan and Ari offered input. "Today we've had a national tragedy," the president said. "Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in a terrorist attack on our country." "We don't know for sure it was a terrorist attack," Dan interjected. "Sure it is," Bush said. "What else do you think it is?" Ari and I agreed it was clearly a terrorist attack. "I'm just saying we have not confirmed anything yet," Dan replied. "We don't know who was responsible." "Then just say apparent terrorist attack," I said, offering my 2 cents. The president added the additional word. Then the president headed to the library to make his brief remarks, staff in tow. At one point, he talked off the cuff about hunting down those folks, before stating that terrorism against our nation will not stand, echoing similar words his father had once said about the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. The president's initial comments were viewed by some as casual and not as strong and reassuring as they should have been. But he would quickly gain his footing and come across as firm, resolved, and reassuring in his words and actions in the days to come. As the president was wrapping up his comments, Ari looked at me. "We were standing behind the curtains that were always used to cordon off a closed protective area for the president." "Should you come with us to Washington?" Ari asked. "I don't think so," I said. "I'm the press corps' only link to the White House. I think I need to stay with them and get them what information I can." Moments later, the president departed. I returned to the filing center and was informed by press assistant Harry Wolf that the broadcast correspondents were getting ready to go live in the schoolyard. I walked outside and provided them color about who the president had spoken with and what he had said. In a time of crisis, I believe it's best to provide information and facts as quickly as possible to the press, and that's what I was trying to do. As I headed back to the filing center, Fox News producer Nancy Harmeyer came running up to me. I knew Nancy well. She had covered us on the campaign. "Scott, our guys in Washington are saying that the executive office building has been hit," Nancy said. "The executive office building?" I asked incredulously. "Yeah, they're saying there is a cloud of smoke coming out from it," Nancy said. "Are you hearing anything?" Now it was hitting even closer to home for me. My oldest brother Mark, a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors and his senior health policy advisor, worked in the executive office building. Many colleagues I knew worked there too, including some close friends. Once again, I felt chills. "I haven't heard any such thing," I said. I immediately proceeded to the filing center to see what I could on television. Reports were coming in that the Pentagon had been hit. Nancy soon confirmed that apparently some of their people had been looking at the smoke from the Pentagon, but thought it was coming from the executive office building, which blocked the Pentagon in their line of sight. it was hard to believe that the home of the Department of Defense could be hit by terrorists. I felt great pain, even as I felt some relief that the executive office building had not been hit. Knowing she might be worried, I thought about my mother at that moment. I was still single at the time. She was in Austin, working as the state comptroller. I stepped outside and phoned her office from my cell. With the unfolding crisis on my mind, I didn't even pause to ask if she was there. I just told her assistants, Nora Alvarado and Lisa Wright, "Tell my mother I'm in Florida with the president. I am fine. Let her know I love her, and I will call her tonight." Then I went back to work. I had some trouble connecting with Claire Buchan, my fellow deputy press secretary back at the White House. I remember it took some time to get through because of the communications network in Washington being overloaded. But once we connected, Claire kept feeding me whatever information she knew, so I could provide what the White House knew to the press corps. Ari also passed along what he knew and what the president was doing as they flew by a circuitous route back to the White House, including stops at two Air Force bases.